The series that we've been, that I've been giving this week and next week has been on Central America, but I'm going to be talking a little bit more broadly and also answering questions about this particular program. I work as the program director for Latin America and the Caribbean of this organization, Heifer Project. So I'll just give you a little bit of background on the organization, and then I'm going to show a short film strip that I've put together about sort of interpreting how we work in Latin America and some of the context, the Latin American context. I suppose that this organization, like some others, we got its beginning because of a visionary. This man's name was Dan West, and Dan was he was a volunteer. He had good instincts, and was the Church of the Brethren volunteer in the Spanish Civil War in the late 30s. And as he was working with tremendous human need and crisis and conflict, handing out powdered milk or milk to children in long lines every day, he started dreaming about what could be a longer-term solution to the problems that he was seeing, and he started making connections between the possibility of what folks back home, the farmers back in Indiana, could do in helping children in that situation. And so he thought, well, why not, instead of a cup, which is a cup of milk drunk today and you have to fill it up again tomorrow, why not a cow? And so the idea took a while to germinate, and actually the first animals, he went back home and organized farmers and churches of the Brethren, and it took several years. So the first shipment of animals wasn't actually sent to Spain, but was sent to Puerto Rico in 1943. So that was the beginning, really. We sort of point back to the beginning of HPI 41 years ago now. It's an organization that has continued then to stress and specialize in livestock, but the name is misleading. The name Heifer Project is, we're going through kind of a study now to see if we should actually change the name. It has a lot of recognition in our constituency, and so it's hard to change a name after 41 years, but it doesn't, heifers are not the only business we're in. We work with all kinds of livestock, large species as well as small, and that includes everything from cattle to draft animals, and down to small species, ruminants particularly, goats, sheep, and pigs, poultry, everything down to the little honeybee, and we're beginning more to go into fish culture now. The organization is an ecumenical or church-related organization which has support of the grassroots of denominations and congregations across the country. And on the board of directors there are, I think, 12 or 13 denominations, including the Methodists, Presbyterians, Episcopalians, Mennonites, Brethren, Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and as of this year, the American Lutheran Church has joined and has membership on the board, not the LCA. The denominations give support with small grants, but most of the money, most of the support comes from donations of individuals and churches, clubs, rotaries, rotary clubs, but mostly churches, and our biggest supporters are usually the Methodist churches across the country and the Presbyterians in terms of denominational support. It's not very well known in some states such as Minnesota, where some of you might be from, or Washington, where others may be known. It's better known in other areas of California and the New England, Mid-Atlantic area and so forth. Our headquarters are in Little Rock, Arkansas. And near there we have a ranch called our International Livestock Center. It's about 1,200 acres, a beautiful facility, beautiful place. And it's a place that we invite you to stop and visit. If you're ever traveling across the country, y'all come on and see us, as we see in Arkansas and Texas. It has an atmosphere much different organization and purpose, but it has somewhat of an atmosphere like Holden in that there are constantly volunteers there. We have college students coming through and spending a year working as volunteers, sometimes working out and getting credit for practical work, learning about livestock, learning about agriculture and so forth in a very practical, hands-on way. There are short-term volunteers that come through for short periods. There are work camps, men's clubs from Iowa, youth camps from all over the country coming through. There's a youth camp almost every week in the summertime at the ranch. And we're building now a learning center, which we anticipate will, I hope, pick up. And I've been observing how this learning center here at Holden operates. I think there's a lot of good ideas that we can pick up on. About 5,000 or 6,000 people come through the ranch as visitors or volunteers or work camps or whatever a year. So we have possibility of being in contact with a lot of people, just as a place like Holden does. And we see our role as one of education in that sense to our constituency or the membership of the churches who are interested in doing something and learning and not only supporting Heifer Project but also learning, as we see more and more importantly, about the context, the political, the social, the economic context in which these projects that we support are working in the third world. We have worked in I think over 110 countries in the history of Heifer Project. That means it's some kind of project over those years. Some controversial ones were in the early 50s sending a shipment of cattle to Russia. We sent a shipment of cattle in 1948 to China. Some places where we went and were very early in solidarity with black farmers in the South before it got to be, or in the very early days of the civil rights movement in the 50s and 60s. So I think Heifer Project has been on the cutting edge in many cases, but in a low-key way, and has seen its role as being a kind of a program that the churches can support and individuals can support that really is a practical application of the gospel mandate to help the poor. Let me mention two principles that we think are pretty important. One is simply that of the living gift, the animal. The animal is a very important part of God's creation. And I'd like to get into some discussion if there's anybody. There has been some debate, and I think that's been more a stronger debate than, say, five or ten years ago at the height of our consciousness in this country about the hunger problems in the world. There is one school of thought that thinks that we should de-emphasize livestock and the eating of meat. But there are, we feel there's a lot of good rationale for the animal in the life of people, and particularly the small farmer, the poor, all over the world.
A livestock that would be in the category of cows, would that not be a utilitarian animal? It would be for milk more so than for meat?
Well, the cattle, the large ruminant, that is, the cow, in many places has several purposes and for people. One being draft. The cattle are used to plow and to work as beasts of burden, also to provide milk. And most of the cases, I think, where we work with animals, it's with that animal, it's for double purpose. It's to provide milk for the family, but then eventually maybe for cash income at some points, and also for meat. And the small ruminant, such as a goat, which is sometimes called the poor man's cow, is much more appropriate for people to be able to manage, people that don't have much land, people that can't manage the costs of handling or raising larger animals. The reason we think that the living gift is important is and should be an important part of agriculture as we look at helping in the long term this hunger problem in the world, that is for the production of food for people, is that, first of all, as I look around, as I travel in the third world and mostly in Latin America, but as my colleagues also do, people have animals and they relate to animals. Animals have always been there, and they will have animals. Now, sometimes animal has been maligned, has been blamed for ecological degradation and that kind of thing. We think it has a lot more to do with management than to directly blame the animal, as in the case of the goat. If there's overgrazing, obviously it's going to cause problems. And so if there's good management, which is one of the things that we get involved in teaching, we do a lot of training as well as just providing animals. The second principle that I want to mention is that of passing on the gift, which is sort of the central part of, or a very important component of every project. Passing on the gift is possible with livestock because of this wonderful thing about living beings is that they reproduce. And so one who receives can also have the opportunity to share in the spirit of Thanksgiving by passing on an offspring, passing on a calf, passing on a kid, passing on piglets to a neighbor. And I think that it would make a lot less sense if we didn't have that component. And it's an ingenious one. It seems very simple, but it takes some getting going sometimes when we work in different countries. But it's an ingenious thing that works, and that people really, when they receive a gift of an animal, they, the poor people that we work with all over the world realize that they just take this as very natural, that they then should share. It is more along the lines of a loan, actually, because they then will raise a calf out of that cow or heifer that they get and pass it on to someone in the next community or their own community. Let me show the film strip, and then that may stimulate some questions, and we'll have a general discussion.
These people that always advocate feed grain don't realize there's millions of acres in this world that's only good for grazing. Absolutely no good for a lot of our grazing grain.
That's right. We'll pick up on that after we've seen the film strip. What about that light up there? Somebody find a switch for that? No, I think your head doesn't show that chair, maybe.
It's this chair.
Maybe you could pull that chair off to get up. Thank you.
Christopher Columbus headed across the great emptiness west of Christendom in 1492 and landed in the Caribbean islands, he was convinced that he had reached Asia. For Spain, it was not only the year of discovery of the Americas, but also the beginning of the colonial rule which lasted for over 300 years. From secure fortifications, the conquerors reached into every sphere of life. Before each military action, the captains of the conquest read a long exhortation, without benefit of interpreters, demanding that the Indians and Native Americans adopt the Holy Roman Catholic faith. Francisco Pizarro, an illiterate pig breeder, triumphantly entered Cusco, Peru in 1533 and seized the heart of the great Inca Empire. Horses, like camels, were once indigenous to Latin America, but had become extinct. Thus, seeing the Spanish conquerors arrive on spirited steeds, the Indians fell to the conquistadors in panic. Their sacred temples were destroyed to make way for churches. Ancient places of worship were made ruins.
This is part of the legacy in Latin America. The plunder and oppression of the Latin American people had begun, and in many ways it continues today. HBI Program Director for Latin America, Jerry Aker, observes,
as I travel through the countries in which Effort Project International works in Latin America, I am brought into contact with the poor and the downtrodden, descendants of those who were enslaved by outside powers and by the elites of their own countries, the landed oligarchy, the military, and even for a long time, the church.
The words of Jesus echo, "Come to me, all you who labor and are heavy burdened, and I will give you rest. Take up my yoke and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble of heart, and you will find rest. For my yoke is easy, and my burden is light."
How can we at HBI walk with our neighbors to the south to help lighten their burdens? Who are these neighbors? What reality are they living today? Latin America is stirring with 120 million children. The population of this continent has exploded. It has more than tripled in half a century. One child dies of disease or hunger every minute. While today there are 350 million Latin Americans, by the year 2000 there will be over 600 million, half of them under the age of 15. Today more than 50 million are illiterate, many living in crowded, disease-ridden slums. In proportion to population, Latin America produces less food today than it did before World War II. So our neighbors are hungry.
And their systematic oppression has long been perpetrated to the accompaniment of indifference and silence on the part of the world community and North America, their neighbors. Minerals and ore have been mined from the earth and sent to Europe and the United States, leaving behind a residue of broken bodies and scarred land, pollution and poverty. The vast forests of Latin America are succumbing to the forces of waves of new settlement, oil exploration, and development, often at a terrible cost to the local population, as so-called civilization encroaches on their lands and threatens their way of life.
Typically, in Latin America, the majority of poor subsistence farmers work on the leftover marginal lands, while the rich own 60 to 80% of the productive land. Thus, land use is primarily for non-food export crops, leading to the relentless impoverishment of the land and the people. The cultivation of cotton, coffee, and tobacco, to mention a few crops, comes to embody the fate of entire nations, and especially the rural poor. Latin American sociologist Eduardo Galeano says, "The more a product is desired by the world market, the greater the misery it brings to the Latin American people whose sacrifice creates it." The neighbors to the south that Effort Project wants to help are mostly poor farmers, herdsmen, and women. Campesinos, the people of the land, and the children.
The winds of change are blowing across Latin America, and the centuries-old alliance of sword and cross is falling apart, as even the role of the church changes. The spirit stirring from the base Christian communities and from the deeply impoverished is profound. Latin American Christians are reading the scriptures in a new light, helping the church to reorient itself, to take the preferential option for the poor in the Catholic and Protestant traditions alike.
As a result of revolutionary stirring and armed clashes in the Central America region, thousands of people are uprooted. Many become refugees. Most have lost loved ones. And again, we are challenged by the gospel. Inasmuch as you have done it unto the least of these, you have done it unto me. Effort Project is there in Central America trying to accompany the poor in their struggle for a better life, for dignity, for control over their own destiny.
In Honduras, Hundreds of families have been helped through dairy goat projects. HPI imported goats, crossed with local animals, have meant better nutrition for children and families in this, one of the poorest countries in the hemisphere.
Edgar and Esperanza Fuentes, who are Guatemalan, show their Christian faith through their work with the poor and practice what they preach by following a simple lifestyle.
In Guatemala itself, HPI has worked intensively for more than a dozen years. Hundreds of cattle, pigs, and other animals have been distributed. In the past several years, under difficult and sometimes dangerous circumstances, regional committees of Guatemalans have been able to carry on with several dozen small livestock projects.
In Nicaragua, HPI worked in pre-revolution days with an agricultural school at Esteli. Father Espinosa, the dear friend of HPI's, laid down his life for his brothers and sisters at the height of the fighting in 1979. Now, HPI continues to help a reorganized agricultural school in Esteli, and a padre, Martin Mateo, who works to make the dreams of the revolution come true through pigs, goats, cattle, and training youth in agriculture.
In the Dominican Republic, HPI's history goes back to the 60s. Some of the original brown Swiss cattle sent in those years are still around, as well as many of their offspring. And HPI now supports new projects working with the best of the native or criollo cattle. Many women and children are involved in heifer projects work in the Dominican Republic with goats and rabbits. HPI representative Ann Crush assists people-to-people projects with small livestock. On lush tropical islands of the Eastern Caribbean, HPI works through the Caribbean Conference churches and supports a variety of small projects such as this woman's poultry project on Dominica, a dairy project at Mirabu Agricultural School in Grenada, and a number of goat projects, all of them seeking to work with self-help groups and other organizations doing service in the area. In South America, HPI concentrates in the Andean region, primarily Peru, Ecuador, and Bolivia. HPI has helped hundreds of Bolivian campesino families who have received heifers and passed on the gift of offspring to their neighbors. In 1983, a grand celebration was held, marking the 26th year since Heifer Project first sent help to Bolivia. Peasant farmers who have participated in the program over the last several years formally constituted their own national organization, made up of grassroots committees from various parts of the country. United Methodist agricultural missionary Walter Henry provides a low-key, skilled HPI presence, working alongside Bolivian farmers and assisting HPI in small livestock projects as well as the larger cattle program. In Ecuador, another country along the Andean chain, HPI's history is also long, and we're indebted to the perseverance of Eduardo Sotomayor, HPI coordinator in the region. While the emphasis for years has been on native Zebu cattle, which are so well adapted to the low humid tropics, training in all aspects of cattle production, as well as small stock, has been important.
Throughout Latin America and the Caribbean, what does it all add up to? What does the future hold? The option for the poor is being taken and lived out as the church itself becomes poor. Priests and pastors and Christians of all kinds work alongside the people in their poverty. Can we do less than to join them? The Latin American bishops reiterated this theme and challenge in Puebla in 1979. In coming near to the poor to accompany and serve them, we are doing what Jesus taught us. When he became our brother, poor as we are. Consequently, our service to the poor is the privileged criteria of our following of Christ.
Well, obviously that just concentrated on Latin America, and Heifer Project does work in Asia, in Africa, and also in the United States. We have a lot of projects. Does that resident talk anymore and keep giving information? I'd just like to respond to some questions that you may have. Yes?
These are bread heifers you would be shipping over there, is that correct?
Well, that would be correct usually, although not necessarily. Sometimes we would send smaller animals because that aren't a breeding age even because of the shipping costs. But also, increasingly in the last few years, we have been depending on local purchase of animals in the country, animals that are born in that country, that are more adapted. And if they're available, if good animals are available in the country, that would be our first choice. So we're not doing as many shipments anymore as we as was traditional in heifer projects.
Do you have some kind of a statistical thing that tells which countries that you work in and the length of time there and the maybe some things about the local organizations and publications?
Yeah. Do we have information on the different countries we work in and the different programs and projects? We have a lot of written information and a lot of interpretive information, description of projects and this kind of thing. I don't have it here. And if anybody's interested in writing to Heifer Project with any kind of request for information, just write to P.O. Box 808 in Little Rock, that's our address, 72203. And just ask whatever your need of information might be and you will be responded to. You can be on a mailing list. We have regular mailings, a newsletter that comes out quarterly, interpretation and so forth.
Well, the farm you have there, is that for livestock getting ready for shipment or?
Well, we have a farm, we have the ranch in Little Rock in Arkansas. Part of the purpose of it is to prepare animals, collect animals and prepare them for shipments. But I think we also have to admit that we see it as an educational center. With that many people coming through and that much participation, that's also an important role that Heifer Project has seen itself as taking on. That is, that the farm is a way for people to be involved, and people can work there, they can visit there, they can also receive information and education and so forth. But some of the shipments go out of there. We also have a farm. A farmer gave us 350 acres up in Massachusetts just 2 years ago, and we're developing that, sending some shipments of animals out of there. And many of our shipments now go to U.S. projects all over the South, for instance, and some in the West with Indian reservations. So, yes, it is partially the purpose of the farm is to prepare and collect and ready animals for projects, but it's not the only purpose.
Is the staff of the Heifer Project primarily North American, or does it use people from Latin America? Do you employ people there? And if so, how long are people?
The question is about staff. And I get letters, we get letters quite often about looking for opportunities to serve or what is our staffing situation. We have salaried staff such as myself. Some of us are in the headquarters in Little Rock. The ranch itself has some salaried staff and depends also a lot on volunteers. We have 6 regional offices, 2 of them in the West Coast, 2 in the West East Coast, and 1 in the central part of the country, that's in Indiana. And so there's a combination of salaried staff there and volunteers. Overseas, we use relatively small numbers of people because we depend in supporting projects where the local people are running them themselves. So we don't run our own projects. You can't go to countries and say, although for interpretation purposes, we would say, this is a Heifer Project. It is somebody else's project and we're supporting them with it. And so we do have some staff overseas, as was shown in this. And also mission organizations such as the Methodist Church have been very, very good in collaborating with us. In Mexico, the HPI representative full-time is a Methodist agricultural missionary also, as in Bolivia, we've had that relationship. And I have a person in Dominican Republic, a woman who's our representative. In Haiti, and there's another person, and so there are some people around the country, around the world, that are working for Heifer Project. And you had another question.
Yes, I had wondered about the local coordinator, and you said that try to help people who are natives take on that responsibility. Mm-hmm.
The comment was made just before the, I think you're a farmer probably, so you, right. You, you speak out of experience, and the comment was that many parts of the world are not appropriate for crop farming, and that is true. There is a large part of the arable surface of the world that is not appropriate for plowing under or for crop farming. Highland regions in Africa, for instance, are grassland regions. And we look very carefully also at tropical areas. We've just made a study and sent someone to Ecuador to respond to looking at three requests in the jungle. And we decided not to support those three projects. We want to do more study. We have to look at the ecological questions about what's happening to the tropical rainforest areas. And the thing that we realize, however, is that animals are there, people will have animals, people will colonize or resettle and settle into the jungle areas and chop down forests. They're not going to stop just because we don't support their project. But we want to look for the most sensitive, technically and anthropologically and ecologically, ways of responding so that livestock are appropriate for the economic development of people.
A lot of people don't realize that we've got millions of acres here in the United States that's being irrigated now that will not be irrigated in 25 years from now. It was fine for grazing.
Yeah.
Now they're irrigating and it's bringing up the natural chemicals, not what the farmers put on, but the natural chemicals and salts out of the soil and killing the soil.
Right.
And we've got that all over the world. So leave it for livestock, leave it for rumen animals.
Also, what is it doing to the water table by drilling these deep wells?
By irrigating, they're taking the water table, that's another. But even if water was available, they can't irrigate because it's bringing the salts up. Mm-hmm. Nature didn't do that. They didn't have that much rain there. And it was all right for livestock.
The Great Plains, the great grassland areas of the Great Plains are, we're a perennial grassland area, and they've been made into annual kind of a
the valley area. Going up towards San Francisco and Sacramento. On one side of the mountain, it brings up salt. The other side, it doesn't. But there are millions of acres that's going to be cut down.
Yeah. The use of land in this country is, a serious thing, and to agricultural policy in this country is something that has to be looked at. In terms of what's the long-term effect, and that is repeated time and time again in every country that we work in, where one of the worst cases and most discouraging for me is to look at Haiti. We're working in Haiti, and I don't know that I can report great results there, but it's just very discouraging to see that over the years the forests, the trees have been cut down, the misuse of land, the crush of population, and even in that country where some corporations are using that land for growing, as in Central America, growing and raising beef on a large scale to send to the United States for our hamburger chains. So that we see as, in terms of appropriate and sensitive socioeconomic development, is not appropriate use of livestock in our estimation, but the American public, in the short term, is benefiting a lot from that. What's happening, though, in Central America is the decrease of land available for production of beans and rice and that kind of thing for local consumption. So we contribute to the hunger problem in our country by this kind of trade relationship with Central America.
My question is, is there any group, maybe not half the program, that are working against some of the large oil, coffee, whatever, there was a thing about Kahlua. Every time, the more our country wishes something, or that our population...
If there's demand on the world market.
Yeah, right. But the more money we create, that's a very striking statement. And I know how true that is. And seeing the picture of the strip mining and the people who now are living there.
Is there any organization working on that problem?
Yeah, working on the problem before those industries start ruining. I mean, how can you slow down our industry when our government sanctions the economic development around the world by our businesses that don't necessarily have a conscience?
I don't think that we would propose or even wish that North American or European industry business is not going to invest in the third world. But I think the hope through this education process that is talked about so much, raising the issues, is that there would be sensitivity in not looking just for the short-term gain when they, go into Latin America and try to regain your investment within 4 to 6 to 7 years and just get everything out that you can in a short period of time. I think that there are some efforts that, and I think probably some multinational corporations have been sensitized. Not my area of expertise, and some of you may know more about that than me.
Well, I think our custom of living, our form of living, we have to lower our standard. That's the only way we're going to be able to help all those people. If we demand the stuff and spend it and throw it away, they're going to keep producing it. We're responsible. We're using too much of the nation's resources over the world. The United States is using way more than their share. So the only thing we can do is lower standard of living.
Statistics probably are, and I guess I just read it yesterday again, that we have about 5 or 6% of the world's population using about close to 40% of the world's resources. And Tom Klein, who's got a book out called The Mustard Seed Conspiracy, I just picked it up in the bookstore. It's really interesting. Makes the point that the party is over. You made the point that we should change our consumptive habits for the benefit of the rest of the world. And Tom Sine's point is that we have no choice about that. That's coming. The big party of the 50s and the 60s, the assumption that we're going to continue to an ever-increasing increase in our standard of living, that is just not in the cards. The people that look at the future and the trends are already telling us that. So it's unfortunately what's going to happen is that the poor are going to, Tom Sine's analysis is that as we go into the next decade and two, the ones that are going to suffer first because of that situation, first of all, are the people that are poor already, then senior citizens, people that are old and growing older, and then it'll cut into the middle class, what is presently the middle class. So his analysis is that, although he's looking for ways that the church and Christians can become positively involved, his analysis is that we have to start thinking seriously about the future, or we're going to have tremendous turmoil.
And until the Catholic Church changes their stand on birth control, we're going to have trouble with the increased population.
Well, the population question is a good one. It was brought up the other day, I think, by another person in this room. There's another side to that, however, that we should be aware of, and that is that where economic development and a decent standard of living, a decent income, a decent standard of living coming out of poverty, where that has happened in certain places in the world, that has automatically brought about a decrease in family size.
Yeah.
The reason that poor people all over the world have large families is essentially as a social security system. And so they always have had 40% mortality of their children, 50% or whatever, and so as long as that's happening, they will have a lot of children in order to assure that somebody's going to take care of them in their old age. And so there is a connection between economic development, social and economic development, and betterment in life conditions, and the decrease in population. So
a presentation that Fritz made the other evening, and he said he was much more worried about our population explosion than he was about the atomic bomb.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. I wasn't at that. But any other questions or comments?
One question. Yeah. Do you make the decision as to what kind of breed of animal you send, or is that made in the local country?
That the whole, the principles that we try to work on are that people decide what their needs are, what they want to do themselves. Whether you're talking about a cooperative association in a community, a women's club, an organization that's working with farmers or whatever. And then we can engage in dialogue with them from the beginning. Once they make a request to us, a proposal, we may visit them, we may give technical assistance and look at and question certain aspects. There are always questions about the production feasibility. We would question if somebody hasn't got experience and said, let's go into pigs or chickens, we would question that right away. It comes up, a red flag comes up in my mind, because it's going to take grain to feed pigs or chickens. And do they have the grain? Will they feed the grain to the pigs rather than to their children? I mean, is there that kind of a relationship? Is there enough corn available? These kind of questions. And so we also ask about the appropriateness of certain species. We might even talk to them about it. If they're talking about cattle, we see they have very little land. Have you considered goats? Do you have any experience in goats in this area? And this kind of thing. So it's a long process. It's when people ask me what my job is, I can't describe it. You know, my kids don't know what I do. They know that I go off all the time and I work for Heifer Fraud, but it's not a easily defined job. You get involved in planning, evaluation, sort of relationship building, it's social work, it's all kinds of things, all wrapped up in one, and it's kind of interesting. Was there?
Yeah. Yes, does the project, along with giving away livestock, do they help the farmers with breeding genetics?
The question is about breeding and genetics. And that is usually one of the objectives of any project, would be genetic improvement. And so that could come about by sending improved male animals, for instance, or purebred animals, or artificial insemination, or buying locally and crossbreeding. Almost all projects are based upon crossbreeding, because purebred animals aren't usually appropriate in harsher conditions with the poor. And I also mentioned that we do stress a lot training. When is this session supposed to be over?
It didn't say. I wish some more fun.
I think it's probably over now.
Have you had any experience with Vern Shields' project of sending used machinery, old, the small machinery we used to have, to those foreign countries? Did you ever run any of that?
No, I haven't run into that. I know of some of those kind of efforts. There's this whole area called appropriate technology that's been in vogue for about 10 years or so. Appropriate technology, looking for the things that are not higher, or even the things that higher technology used in our agriculture. Sometimes I think appropriate technology is not so appropriate, because we are looking at gimmicks and gadgets and all kinds of things that we dream up, that certain people dream up, that might, we think, well, that might be just the ticket for those people. And so if it can't be built in the local situation, oftentimes I would question whether or not it should be sent from here. On the other hand, in certain situations where they do need implements and tools, and it will fit within what they can maintain and repair and that kind of thing, it's probably okay.
Well, I know I get donated a gasoline engine with a wire jacket on it and a small hammer mill. Mm-hmm. He said that's what they need, that type of equipment, stuff that we had used 40 years ago but no longer used here in the United States. They don't want this modern stuff. And he had made a special, and he would fix it up and repair it and send it. Now they have this little tractor project going.
Yeah.
have a small tractor with the influence on it and send that out in various countries, a little bit like they're doing with livestock.
Well, I think probably we'll officially call the session to an end, and but if anybody wants to sit around and chat longer, that's fine with me.
Was it about 303 or
808.
Oh, 808. And what's the zip? Give the address again.
72203, Little Rock, Arkansas.
H-E-I-F-E-R.
Yeah, as in young cow.
I'm sure if we get to Little Rock, you'll get it.
Yeah. Right. Did I see a hand up over here, or did I?
I'm going to ask what about oppressive governments that might actually be against self-improvement? Do you run into that or not?
Very much. Yeah. And that's
worth it.
That's why.
What would an example be that?
I don't know. I don't want to repeat examples, but maybe most of you weren't here on the session I started out with this week. A couple of you were. One example would be in Guatemala, in Central America, where throughout the 70s we worked with campesinos, or poor people that migrated from the highlands into the jungle area to resettle and start a new life. We supported about 35 cooperatives, cattle cooperatives there. And also in some other areas we supported bee cooperatives, bee production for honey. And because of the political situation there, most of those, or all of those, during the time at the end of the 70s when oppression was very heavy in Guatemala, all of them were destroyed. The army came in and many of the leaders were killed. In some cases, participants were killed, cooperativists and so forth. And so we've lost contact with those particular people. They're not organized anymore. That's a good case, and I asked a question the other night because we were kind of reflecting on this problem of how hard it is sometimes to accomplish anything, particularly when it gets destroyed and something good is going. And so the question was it worth doing, even though it was destroyed?
The people themselves, they couldn't pick up the
money
or stealing something.
Well, the cooperatives were really disintegrated because of the oppression from the army as it came into those into that area.
And the army was that government?
That was the government of Guatemala's army.
Is it still the same regime farther now?
Well, it's the same basic folks that are the same military generals of Guatemala. It's a different set of generals right now than it was in the 80s. Two new sets of generals. Well, you all come on and see us sometime in Arkansas, and we'll show you and talk to you about our program. And if any of your churches are interested in getting involved, certainly would appreciate that kind of involvement as well. We have projects all over the world, and there's a lot of ways to get involved.
Thank you.